Do you have music going?
Sure.
No. Okay, well, hopefully we're...
Thanks so much. Good to see you.
Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion. That'll determine what the future will bring. I have to remind you the views that are expressed here, not those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and We welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being because we have this on the line right now. John Lott, he's a visiting scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, and we're going to be talking about his latest book, The Bias Against Guns. Mr. Lott, thank you so much for being with us.
Well, good to talk to you again.
Well, we've had a lot on several times before, talking about, of course, the gun issue. And he is, of course, really one of the leading experts and researchers on this subject. And there's a tremendous amount of information out there. The trouble is the Americans are not getting it because of the bias within the media. And, of course, his book simply recounts instance after instance after instance where there are wonderful stories there that prove not that guns are harmful, but that guns actually save lives. And if you weigh the danger of guns to the benefit, why, of course, the benefits come out far, far and away in favor of the right of the people to keep and bear arms. Would that be a fair statement?
I think that's exactly right. That on net, the presence of guns save a lot more lives and protect a lot more people from harm than they cost.
Well, then why is it that so many people have been convinced that guns are really a danger and we should limit their use?
Well, I mean, guns can pose a danger. They do make it easier for bad things to happen, but they also make it easier for people to protect themselves and prevent bad things from happening. It's just that we only hear about the bad things, as you say. You look at the media coverage, and my guess is most people in your listening audience probably can't even remember when they saw a story, let's say, on the national TV news or even the local TV news about a citizen who used his gun to stop a crime or save a life. Yet the best evidence we have indicates that people use guns defensively over 2 million times a year. That's about 4.5 times more frequently than guns are used to commit crime. And it's understandable why they feel that way or haven't heard those stories. When I went back for this book to look at all the television news stories on ABC, NBC, and CBS for their national morning and evening news broadcast, they had about 190,000 words worth of television stories on contemporaneous gun crimes during that year. By contrast, there was not one single story during the entire year about someone who had used his gun in order to stop a crime or save a life. You can look at the different newspapers around the country. Time after time, you see the same thing. New York Times had about 51,000 words on gun crime stories, contemporaneous gun crime stories during 2001. Had only one very short story buried at the back of the newspaper about a retired police officer who had used his gun in order to stop a robbery. But very dramatic stories where citizens save lives just don't seem to be able to make it into the news.
Well, let's give a couple of examples that you use. There is one of the story of the Appalachia Law School shooting. Why don't you tell that story? Because I think it so beautifully illustrates the point you're trying to make.
Right. Well, this was last year. Maybe many of your listeners remember it. There was an attack at the Appalachian Law School in Virginia towards the beginning of last year, and a couple of people were killed. A couple students, upon hearing the shots, ran to their cars, got their pistols from their cars, came back, pointed their gun at the attacker, yelled at him to drop his gun. And when he did, they tackled him and held him there until the police arrived. Now, if you do what's called a nexus search, which is a computerized news search of news stories around the country, you'll find well over 200 separate news stories around the country in just the week after the attack. Amazingly, though, only two outlets, both of them local newspapers in Virginia near where the attack occurred, actually talked about in their stories about the students who had gone to their car, gotten their guns, and used them to stop the attack. So many of the other media would go and simply say that the attack was stopped by students who tackled the attacker or subdued him. The Washington Post, for example, was one place where they simply mentioned that he was tackled. The concern I had was I decided to go and call up some of these reporters and just kind of find out what they knew and why they decided to report things the way they did. And so, for example, I called up different reporters. One of them was Maria Glad, who was the reporter who wrote the story for the Washington Post. And, in fact, when I asked her if she knew about these other details, she said she did. But that she hadn't included them in the story and just decided to describe it as being stopped by students tackling the attacker because she simply didn't have space. She only had 930 words to write about the story, and she decided if she was going to mention anything about the attack being stopped, it was simply easier to mention that the attacker was tackled by the students.
Rather than the fact that the guns were actually what saved a further life from being taken.
Right. I don't think I wouldn't go and advise people to run across an open area against somebody who's armed unless they were armed themselves. In fact, one could even argue that the way the story was written may even endanger lives to the extent that it gives people the misimpression that simply running up against somebody who has a weapon is a smart thing to do.
All right, fine. Well, Chris, one of the examples you gave was this announcement. Apparently, it was an advertising campaign, and you correct me because you probably remember the statistics better than I, but it was something to the fact that every day 10 children are shot by guns. Is that the figure that was put out?
Well, yeah, the Clinton administration spent literally millions of dollars on these public service ads, just putting them together. They didn't have to pay for the ads to actually be run. And I'm sure a lot of your listeners remember hearing these, where they would talk, have voices or pictures of young kids as young as 4 to as old as 8 years of age. They never had any children over 8 years of age appearing in these ads. And they would make it appear that these were primarily accidental gun deaths. They'd have ads where they would talk about a child shooting another child. And surely the impression that was being given is that we were talking about deaths involving kids under age 10 and that probably a lot of these were accidental gun deaths. And the Clinton administration, part of the money that they spent was for a PR firm to go around and try to find out what images and what messages would be most likely to get people to give up their guns and decide not to own them at home. And they struck upon this thing about using the children. The problem is, this is a completely misleading number when they talked about 10 children a day dying from this, because in order to get anything up to that, you have to basically look at all gun deaths under age 20. And when you find that, it's overwhelmingly 17, 18, and 19-year-olds involving homicides, and overwhelmingly that number is driven by homicides from gang fights and gun over drug turf. And which is important, and somebody can worry about that, but the notion of trying to get guns out of law-abiding citizens' homes or require that they lock them up has nothing to do with gang fights over drug turfs among people who are 18 or 19 years of age. And in fact, when you look at the numbers, which are most analogous to what the ads were trying to push, in 1999, for example, there were 31 accidental gun deaths in the United States for children under age 10. But even that is a larger number than would accurately reflect what was basically going on in the story with young kids shooting other young kids, because most of those shootings actually involved adults who had long criminal records who were firing the guns. When you break it down, you found that in 1999, there was only 6 cases in the United States where a child under 10 either accidentally shot themselves or another child under 10. In fact, over the 5 years from 1995 through 1999, there was between 5 and 9 cases in any of those years where such a case occurred. But people, when they hear this, think that it must be much more frequent because even though these cases are so rare, they get extensive news coverage when they occur, up to 90 different news stories I've found around the country. And that's just separate news stories. So many of those would be reprinted multiple times in different publications. Someplace like USA Today would be virtually certain of having a story on each of those events when they occurred. And so it does two things. It tremendously exaggerates the risks of having guns in the home, these ads did. And my concern is that people probably died as a result of those ads, because by scaring people into not owning guns in their home, they took away what turns out to be the most effective means for people usually to be able to defend themselves when they're confronted by a criminal.
And, of course, there are instances, and not infrequently, where criminals will come in, and criminals, if they know there are no guns in the house, they're going to be willing to come in. And you point out in your book how burglars are really very concerned about the presence of guns in the house, and certainly they have, in interviews, readily admitted that if they think there's a gun in the house, they're not going to go into that house. They don't want to get shot.
Well, yeah, even if they don't know the guns in the house per se, if they think that there are more guns in a neighborhood, you can look across, they'll be less likely to break in, especially when they know people are there. You look across countries, you see the same phenomenon. There's something called hot burglaries, which are burglaries that occur while the residents are in the dwelling. In the United States, the hot burglary rate's 13%. But in a country like Britain, for example, it's 60%. Out of every 10 times a burglar breaks into a house in Britain, the residents are there when the burglar breaks in. Burglars don't have any fear. And American burglars spend about twice as long casing a house before they break in, precisely to help ensure that nobody's there, no residents are in the house when they break in. And the surveys that you mentioned by Rand and other places of burglars that have been caught consistently show that the reason why they spend so much time casing a dwelling before they break in is precisely, as you say, because they're concerned that they're worried about running into a resident there who's going to be able to defend themselves.
Well, now, Kirstie, you have statistics that show in the states where they have the right to carry weapons, right to carry laws, that actually the incidence of violent crime actually goes down, doesn't it?
Right. Well, we've had a lot of experience with this now. We have 35 states that have adopted these laws. Some of these states have had these laws for as long as 70 years. And what you find is that for each additional year that a state has these laws in effect, you'll see about a 1.5% drop in murder rates over and above the changes in murder rates in other states. And after literally accounting for hundreds of factors, from law enforcement to drug activity to changing demographics and income and poverty. And there are other things that are more important in reducing violent crime. I think the evidence shows unambiguously that the most important single factor for reducing violent crime are the police. But I think that the police themselves understand, even though they're so crucial in reducing crime, they virtually always arrive on the crime scene after the crime's been committed. And that raises real questions about what do you advise someone to do when they're confronted by a criminal. And simply telling them to behave passively is not very good advice. In fact, it's actually a relatively dangerous thing for them to do as compared to having a gun.
And you actually have some statistics about how much safer it is for a woman to have a gun, when she's confronted by a criminal than to actually just do absolutely nothing. Would you want to go over those statistics?
Sure, that's exactly right. You find that the most dangerous thing that a woman can do when she's confronted by a criminal is to use her fist. The next most dangerous thing is for her to run away. The reason for both of those is that for using your fist, you're virtually always talking about a male criminal doing the attacking against a female victim in this case. And there's a large strength differential, though. And for a woman to use her fist, there's a high likelihood of a physical response back from the male attacker, and given that, a high likelihood of either serious injury or death. The reason why running away doesn't turn out to work too well is that if they can run away and escape, maybe lock a door or something behind them, that's great. The problem is that women tend to be, on average, significantly slower runners than men are. And if they get caught in the process of being tackled and subdued, they can get serious injuries. And there can be additional violence that ensues from that. And one can go through and rank a whole bunch of different things, but you find passive behavior is actually kind of in the middle of the range of different things that you can do. But having a gun is by far the safest of any of the things that that have been studied. Passive behavior for women, in fact, is about 2.5 times more likely to end up resulting in serious injury to a woman than a woman who has a gun to defend herself.
Well, of course, the impression they're going to give us is, oh, well, you know, if you have a gun, I mean, the chances of you're getting hurt by your own gun is so great that you wouldn't want to have a gun. And this is the lie that's told over and over and over again. And, you know, they say figures don't lie, but liars can certainly figure. How do you respond to that statement that, you know, if you have a gun in the house, the chances of you're getting shot by that gun is, you know, they run these figures up to some phenomenal level.
Yeah, well, usually the way the statement's made is that if you have a gun in the home, you or a loved one is much more likely to end up being killed by a gun than you are to go and kill an attacker. And it's based upon a few studies that have been published by the same sets of authors in medical journals, and it's really a dangerous number. I don't know how much damage that's done, but just give you an idea how the research was put together. They'll go and look at a city over the course of a year, over the course of a few years, and they'll identify people who died from gunshots in or near a residence. And then they'll ask the relatives of the deceased whether or not the person who died owned a gun, or whether a gun was owned in the residence nearby the attack. And then they'll assume that if the answer is yes to either of those questions, that it was in fact that gun that was used in the death. In fact, when people have gone back and looked at it, that wasn't a very good assumption, because even including suicides, at most 14% of the gun deaths could be actually attributed to the gun that was owned there by either the person who died or someplace else in the residence. The other 86% of the deaths were actually attributed to a weapon that was brought in from the outside. The other side of this, the benefit side, is we're tremendously overestimating the cost by a factor of over 6. And on the other side, we're underestimating the benefits, because the only benefits that's usually looked at are cases when you actually go and kill the attacker. That's incredibly rare. Fewer than 1 out of every 1,000 times that people use a gun defensively is the attacker killed. And the vast majority of times, something like 95% of the time or so, simply brandishing a gun is sufficient to go and cause a criminal to go and break off an attack. It's not necessary that they actually have to fire a warning shot even, let alone kill the person or wound them. And wounding itself is extremely rare. I mean, it may be about 6 times more frequent than killing the attacker, but you're still talking about something that's just a tiny fraction of 1% of the time that people use a gun. And so, you know, you can see if you're ignoring all those times where you brandish a gun as producing a benefit, or firing a warning shot, or even wounding the attacker, you've lost virtually the entire benefit. You're not even counting that from using a gun.
All right, we're going to just have to take a little break here, and we'll be right back with our special guest this evening, John Lott, talking about the bias against guns. And believe me, it's a very real bias by those who would disarm the American people. Well, this is Dr. Stan here, and our guest is John Lott, and he's written a wonderful, wonderful book, The Bias Against Guns, going into all of the cliches and the things that have been said to try to give the impression that the guns are extremely dangerous and we've got to lock them up, or we've got to put locks on them so they can't be used because some child might find a gun. How often does a child find a gun in a year and actually do any harm with that? Is there any figures on that?
Well, the Centers for Disease Control has data on how many times you have accidental gun deaths involving children in the United States. And basically what we did was we took that list and did a search, a news story search on each case, because each case ends up getting covered in the media. And and then we're able to get information on who fired the gun and different information about the circumstances. And what we found is that between 1995 and 1999, there was between 5 and 9 cases a year in the entire United States where a child fired a gun and harmed another child. And to get an idea of how small that number is, I mean, you have over 90 million Americans that own guns in the United States. They own something like 250 million or so guns. And you have over 40 million children under age 10. You know, that it's such a tiny rate. I mean, if you compare it to other things, common household items that children die from, I suppose one of the ones that struck me the most was just one type of plastic water bucket, 5-gallon plastic water bucket. You have about 36 children a year who die from 5-gallon plastic water buckets. That's more. That's for children under age 5. You have 36. That's more children under age 5 dying from 5-gallon plastic water buckets than under age 10 dying from any type of accidental gun death. You have more children under age 5 drowning in bathtubs in the home, 88, than you have children under age 15 dying from any type of accidental gun death, you had 81 in 99. You know, you could go through many other items in the home and get similar things, you know, bicycles, electrical heating units causing fires, a whole range of things that create many more deaths even than those things like bathtubs. And yet people don't have fears of those things. And so much of the fear right now is generated by this just complete exaggeration of the risks that exist in the home from people owning guns. And you have places like in California, which have passed laws that mandate that people lock up their guns when they're at home. The evidence I have indicates that that's actually led to more deaths. That it hasn't stopped juvenile accidental gun deaths, and it hasn't reduced crime. The reason why it hasn't reduced juvenile accidental gun deaths because they simply don't occur in households with law-abiding families.
Now, I'm going to have to interrupt you there because we want to, of course, I get this, and we're going to have to take just a very, very momentary break as we bring one of our stations back online with us here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest this evening is John Lott. We're talking about his book on the bias against guns. And, of course, Dr. Lott is bringing out the fact that that this idea that if you lock up guns, you're going to save lives. And yet, of course, you lock up guns, they're not there to protect the family from other things. And the number of children who are actually injured by a gun is infinitesimal. And the fact that, you know, if you take children under 5, more children die every year under 5 from the 5-gallon water, plastic water bucket there than the children under 10 die as a result of gun accidents. And, of course, it depends on how they manipulate these statistics. But there's so much pressure being put on today. Oh, if we only had gun locks on, you know, so we could, you know, nobody could use this gun. Or, you know, if we just had these guns all locked away, then they wouldn't be a danger. Do you want to address those two issues?
Sure. I mean, I've seen the type of thing that you're talking about happen from time to time. A couple years ago, I was testifying before the state legislature in Maryland, and they had people from the state medical association and different public interest groups just talking about the huge number of children in Maryland who die each year from accidental gun deaths, and that it's an epidemic and we need to go and do something about it. It turns out in the 10 previous years in Maryland, there were a total of 2 children under age 15 who had died in the whole state over 10 years, a total of 2. Who had died from accidental gunshots. Neither of those deaths actually involved a child under 15 firing a gun. Both of them were due to adults. And a gun lock isn't going to stop and both of them with criminal records, by the way, a gun lock isn't going to go and stop an adult from firing his own gun. It's not meant to try to do that. The problem is, as you say, when these laws get passed, it's the law-abiding households where the risk of having these accidental gun deaths is essentially zero. I mean, you're talking about a number that's akin to children in those households dying from lightning strikes. They're the ones who either become afraid to own their guns or go and lock up their guns so they're not readily accessible. You don't see any changes in juvenile accidental gun deaths because to the extent to which these deaths occur, they occur in households where a criminal, somebody with a long history of arrest for violent crime, is the one who fires the gun. And they're not the type of people who go and lock up their guns, and they're adults in any case, so it's unlikely that a lock would do much to stop them. These people, generally, because of their criminal records, aren't even eligible to own a gun. And yet so why would they lock it up? But what you do find happening is that since the law-abiding households lock up their guns or don't own them as frequently as they used to, they become more vulnerable to crime. Criminals become emboldened to attack people in their homes, and the likelihood of a successful attack by a criminal goes up. You find that in the 17 states that have passed these so-called safe storage or child protection acts, you find a total annual rate of about 300 more murders than you would have seen otherwise without those laws.
Well, I think that this is the thing. I mean, everything is perception. They're playing on our emotions. Everybody loves children. No one wants to see a child get hurt. But, of course, people do not have access to the true information about how often guns actually prevent crimes. And that's the thing. If you take away, guns from the people, you end up with a state of lawlessness where when guns are outlawed, and I hate to be trite, but then only the outlaws have guns.
Well, I think there's some real truth to that. I mean, I know it's a statement that's been poo-pooed, and I probably didn't take it as serious as I should have many years ago before I started doing this research, even though I've published, well over 90 academic articles primarily dealing with different types of crime-related problems. And I've been chief economist at the U.S. Sentencing Commission and what have you in Washington. But I don't think I appreciated how true the statement that you made was until I started actually looking at this. The problem with most gun laws is that when you pass them, it tends to be the most law-abiding citizens who obey them, not the criminals. And to the extent that you disarm law-abiding citizens relative to criminals, you actually see increases in violent crime rather than drops. And, you just take an extreme case. Let's say tomorrow we would pass a law that banned guns. Well, who's going to turn in their guns? It's going to be the most law-abiding citizens, the people you have absolutely the least to worry about in terms of using a gun improperly. And the real sad thing is that those people are then more vulnerable. Criminals are going to be emboldened to attack them because they're going to have less to worry about, and the criminals who haven't given up their guns or probably are going to go and attack people who are relatively weak physically anyway and are easy targets for them, are going to feel that they have much less to worry about.
We'll be back here in just a moment with John Lott. Welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening, John Lott. The book is The Bias Against Guns, excellent, excellent book. And I really enjoyed reading it and gives you the information that you need to have, when you're discussing this and understanding how we are being manipulated by the media, by the people who write these articles. Many of them have a personal bias against guns. We were talking about that, the bumper sticker. I remember about 40 years ago when the bumper sticker came out, when guns are outlawed, only the outlaws will have guns. And, of course, the other side came up with another bumper sticker, and it said when in-laws are outlaws, only outlaws will have in-laws. And, of course, you know, everybody thought it was very, very funny. But, of course, they were using ridicule to defame a very legitimate situation. Who in the listening audience honestly believes that people who are criminals are going to abide by the laws? And they're just not going to do it. And, of course, what do you disarm the law-abiding citizens? Why you make them very susceptible to criminals, which is why, certainly one reason why, our founding fathers wanted people to have a right to keep and bear arms. They also, of course, wanted people to have a right to keep and bear arms because of fear of government. But we don't have to discuss that issue at all. Tonight, we're just talking about the statistics about having a gun in the house. Does it make you safer? Does it make you living in a more dangerous situation? And Dr. Lotz of research has certainly shown that it actually tends to protect individuals, and how often through the years why people, when they have a gun and they're accosted, simply brandishing the gun, usually the criminal will run the other direction. Now, certainly they've outlawed guns over in Australia, in Canada, in Great Britain, with the idea that we can just take the guns away from the citizens, why they're not going to be any gun crimes. But what's happened in Australia, in Canada, and in Great Britain to gun crimes once they took the guns away from the law-abiding citizens?
Right. Well, in Australia, in 96, they banned about 60% of guns by sales volume. And but they also passed a law that made it a felony for anybody to use a gun in order to defend themselves. And in the 5 years that we have crime data after that, it's pretty depressing. You've seen well over a 50% increase in home invasions. You've seen by criminals. You've seen over a 40% increase in rape rates and armed robberies. It's been a very dramatic increase in violent crime. And in fact, an unprecedented increase in Australian history in terms of the increase in violent crime. In Britain, in 1996, they passed a law that banned handguns, and they also made it a crime. A felony for somebody there to use a shotgun, for example, to defend themselves. And there's been a huge increase in gun crimes there. I mean, in handgun crimes, even though they're supposedly outlawed now. And Britain has still a lower homicide rate than we do, but the gap's getting much smaller very quickly. And now their overall violent crime rate in Britain is more than twice what the violent crime rate here is in the United States. There's an interesting book that came out about a year ago by a woman named Joyce Lee Malcolm, who's a historian at Bentley College and Harvard University. And she studied homicides in the United Kingdom over the last 1,000 years. And homicide rates were extremely high up until the time when guns started being introduced to the country. And then they began to fall. And there was essentially about over a 500-year period of time, almost 600-year period of time, when you had almost what seemed to be a continuous decline in homicide rates. It was basically until you got to about 1920 when the first gun laws got passed there that you started to see a reversion of that trend. It's amazing how few homicides England used to have. You have, in 1900, for example, there were 2 gun homicides in London, in all of London. And but the increases in homicide rates that we've seen in England have come after each time they've passed a new gun control law during the last century.
And, of course, now, of course, we're told that, you know, the British bobby, the British policemen, you know, don't carry guns. Because,
well, they do now.
And I that's the point I wanted you to make. Now things have gotten so bad that the British police have had to start carrying guns. Is everybody armed or just certain of the officers?
My understanding is the vast majority of officers are now armed.
You know, that, I think, gives a pretty good commentary of what happens when you disarm the public.
Right. Well, I mean, these increases in murder rates and other violent crimes occurred after they passed these restrictions, not before. I mean, it seems very difficult for one to look at this and say that the gun laws helped. You know, there may be debates about what else may have also changed at that time, but for all the different gun laws to continually see increases each time you've had a new gun control law there, it makes it extremely difficult for someone to go and argue that these produce benefits.
Well, you know, the trouble is, you know, that the other side is so well organized, and they, you know, they come up with this compassionate, concerned attitude towards children, and they use these statistics on children, and, somebody once said people are always making up statistics, and the people on the other side really are making up a lot of their statistics. In other words, they'll twist the statistics around to come up with a conclusion that has nothing to do with fact. Would that be a fair statement?
Well, I mean, there's a lot of fear out there, and the numbers that I'm giving, the 31 accidental gun deaths for children under age 10, you can go to the Centers for Disease Control website, and you can plug in not only looking at guns, their mortality morbidity report section, but you can look at everything from bicycles to you name it, just about they have it broken down. You know, drownings, decapitations, you name it. It seems like they have some breakdown for it. Different types of fires, a whole bunch of different types of fires they have it broken down for. You would think that guns would be a significant way that children die, and yet they account for virtually nothing of the total number of accidental deaths. You're talking about just, you know, a tiny fraction of 1% of accidental deaths in the country involving children involved guns. I get calls from the media sometimes when there's an accidental gun death that occurs. There'll be a discussion about saying, well, what new law should we have? Should we pass these gun lock bills or something? And so they'll call me up. And one of the questions I've taken to start asking the media people is, why is it that you're reporting about this one type of death? I mean, I have 5 kids. I can't imagine what it would be like to lose any of my children for any reason. But it's not clear to me why this one type of death is so much more tragic than any other way that children die. And my concern, as I tell them, is that by exaggerating this one type of death, the exclusion of what seems like virtually all others, you're giving people a real misimpression that can endanger lives. And I ask them why they do it, and the usual answer I get back is, well, it's because it's so rare that man bites dog is much more of a news story than dog bites man. The problem is twofold, I think. First is that it doesn't explain it, because there are lots of very rare ways that kids die. Some of them extremely gruesome. Some of them that are even rare or just as rare or not as rare as accidental gun deaths that don't get anywhere even the tiny fraction of the coverage, if they get covered at all, of accidental gun death. And secondly, it may be because it's so rare that they're covering it, but that's hardly the impression that people get. People see these news stories or they see some general discussion about it, and they literally become afraid that something bad's going to happen to them and their kids if they have a gun in the home. And you think of how many things you face out there where you have, let's say, 90 million people that own something, and you have 6 cases a year where a child's going to get a hold of it and use it to go and harm either themselves or another child. I mean, it's just completely out of all reason that we've developed this fear. But it's like Chinese water torture. By constantly having this extensive coverage time after time of these things, there are a lot of people who are just really scared to death of guns.
Well, I certainly agree with you. And let's see who we have on the line here. Somebody's calling in. Our producer's going to pick that up, and we'll hope we'll have him on the board here in just a minute. Right now, I guess it's Mike in Santa Cruz, and if you'll just screen Mike over here. Hi, Mike. Do you have a question or comment?
Yeah, I got a question. it seems like there must be some way to come up with statistics having to do with how children have benefited from the presence of guns in society. I know you can't really come up with it would be too suppositional, I suppose, to say X number of children's lives were saved by guns, because you can't tell if they actually would have died because of some confrontation. But maybe instances of when children's lives were protected by guns. Say the parents had a gun in the house. And,
right. There's not systematic data that the government collects on that, unfortunately. But
well, they won't.
But what you can, and that's, we could talk about that too, about how government research is done on this issue. But the I know just myself, in the 1 year prior to writing the book, I came across 12 stories of young children who had used guns to fairly unambiguously save lives, whether it be the lives of their mom or their grandmother. And you just compare that to the number that you know, the more certain number that you know of six cases in 1999 where a child under 10 either shot themselves or another child under 10, you have a rate of almost twice. There's one case in Louisiana I could mention briefly where I don't know if you know this drug. It's called Oxycontin. It's a painkiller often given to cancer patients who are in the terminal stages of cancer to control the pain. And there's some gangs around the country that break into cancer patients' homes in order to steal the drug, because if you take it when you're not in extreme pain, it produces hallucinations. And apparently there was this one gang in Louisiana which had broken into a number of cancer patients' homes, severely beaten several cancer patients that they'd stolen the drug from, killed several of them. And one night they came across, about a year ago, they came across the home of a woman who was dying from cancer. She was down to less than 90 pounds in her late 30s. And her son saw these four, her 10-year-old son saw these four men in ski masks coming up to the side of the house and talking about how they were going to break in. And so he went and got the family shotgun. It was only him and his mother home at night. And when they broke into the house, he wounded one of the attackers in the head. And all of them were arrested later that evening when they took the wounded person to a nearby hospital for medical attention. There's another case of a young child in Indiana, South Bend, Indiana, last year, where his mother had left him. She was a drug addict. Her former boyfriend, who was a pusher, thought that the grandmother who was taking care of the child had jewelry that he should steal, had come there with a knife, had actually stabbed the grandmother a couple times and was threatening to slit her throat. When the child went and got a family rifle, his father, before his father had died of cancer, had taught him how to shoot, and apparently starting when he was 8. And with a single shot, he killed the this drug dealer before he was able to slit his grandmother's throat. You know, so there are a number of cases like that. One that you would think would be fairly dramatic cases. But I'm sure when I talk to the media people that they have an aversion against publicizing those types of stories. And I think it's the last thing that they want to do is glorify in any way the notion of a child using a gun, whether it's a dramatic life-saving case or not. And, you know, but they surely aren't hesitant to just play over and over again the few cases where there's an accidental gun death that occurs involving a child.
And you actually pointed out, because this is not so much with children, but, you know, in these school shootings, that almost a third of them were stopped by people who had guns that stopped the shooters from killing more people, and yet that was literally never mentioned or almost never mentioned by the major media.
Right, well, yeah, it is a third of the attacks, and you go and do Nexus searches, these computerized news searches of news stories, and you find that about 1% or fewer of all the news articles will mention when these attacks had actually been stopped by citizens with guns. There's 30 between the fall of 97 and the end of last year, 32 students had died on school property from gunshots. And that includes not only the public school shootings, but also gang fights and robberies and even an accidental gun death.
So
I'm not going to try to minimize the 32. But what I would say is when you think about an annual rate over essentially about 6 years of school, so you have about five a year who die, and you're thinking about that there's about 60 million school-age kids in elementary through secondary school in the United States. You know, I don't want to minimize that, and surely these traumatic events deserve a lot of attention when they do. But you can't weight that to the exclusion of everything else. And you have to trade it off against cases where kids have used guns and others have used guns to save lives. It has to be a question, what's the net impact? Not just whether can I identify some bad things that have happened.
Anything else you want to ask, Mike?
That's all, thanks.
Okay, fine. Well, thanks very much for calling. And we have somebody else on the line. We'll have him with us in just a moment. But, you know, the great tragedy is how the public can be manipulated. One of the things that I was so interested in your book, and something I didn't know, was the fact that many of our congressmen, of course, are constantly voting for gun laws to take guns away from law-abiding citizens. But there, and certainly in Washington, D.C., it is illegal for anybody to have a gun, except for congressmen on congressional property. What's the background of that legislation?
Right. Well, as you say, there's often exceptions for the people who pass the laws for different things. And in this case, for a long time, there's been a regulation since basically the time when they started regulating this that exempted congressmen from any restrictions on having guns on federal property. And of course, they can go and take the gun with them in D.C. if they're traveling, let's say, from Virginia to federal property, even though when they pass through the parts of D.C. which aren't federally owned. And one can imagine that there were some congressmen who were writing these rules that felt that they would be safer if they had the option of being able to have a gun with them.
But it seems like we have a two-tiered society. We have an elite that can carry guns, and we have us common folks that can't. That's incongruous.
Right. Well, you know, it's not just congressmen. You see people like Mayor Daley in Chicago, who has 24-hour round-the-clock bodyguards to protect him. And there's even parts of the city which he apparently refuses to go to, and yet he won't allow people in those dangerous areas to be able to own a handgun to be able to protect themselves. He'll let large contributors to his campaigns go and get a permit every once in a while to have a handgun in the city. But, you know, it's not just politicians. You see celebrities. You have people like Rosie O'Donnell, who criticized people carrying concealed handguns, saying that it shouldn't be legal and no one should be able to do it. And yet her own bodyguards and the bodyguards for her children had applied for concealed handgun permits. And, she lives in Greenwich, Connecticut, which when I looked at it, hadn't had a murder in the preceding 10 years. And one can appreciate the fact that she's a celebrity, and she says that she felt that threatened and at risk. But that's the same reason, feeling threatened and at risk, that many other people want to have a gun. And they live in much more dangerous areas than she does.
I think that Rosie gives hypocrisy a bad name. Let's go to Ron calling in from Richland, Washington. Hi, Ron. How are you doing?
Hi, Dr. Stan. Enjoyed your guest. I have to echo on his sentiments. I think one of the first things they want to do is disarm the citizenry. And that's, to me, one of their first steps in imposing their totalitarian government.
I've come to agree with you more over time. I don't think I would hear myself saying that even 6, 7, 8 years ago. But I think it's a very thought-out process in that they want to make it gradually more and more costly for people to have guns. And as they do, there'll be fewer people who will have them, be familiar with them, and it'll be easier for them to pass additional and additional restrictions. It's one reason why, for example, the gun control groups work with groups that want to ban hunting, because they know that children who grow up in families that go hunting are much more likely to own guns themselves when they grow up later. And, you know, it's a very long process. I've read statements and seen statements by people in gun control groups saying that, well, now they've won the battle in the long run because schools are so indoctrinating, public schools are so indoctrinating kids with a hatred of guns, that in future generations it'll be very easy for them to go and make their case. And for your other point there, I think people who don't have guns, and this is something else I've come to believe too over time, feel more vulnerable, and they feel more dependent upon government to try to protect them. And I think you know, there are probably other government policies that we could talk about that do the same thing, but the one other point I would make is unions are to the Democratic Party what the NRA has basically been to the Republican Party. And I think there's a conscious recognition of that on the part of Democrats generally. And so things that they can do to try to weaken people's attachments to guns and gradually reduce the number of people who have them, I think is something that's more than a few of them recognize is a long-term way of gradually helping their own political strength relative to the Republicans.
Well, unfortunately, they have embraced a socialistic philosophy. Maybe it's because of their own ego that they want to literally micromanage everyone else's life.
What's the view of having experts do things as opposed to trusting individuals?
If I need their help, as far as I'm concerned, I'll ask them for it.
Right. Well, so I understand exactly what you're saying, and I think you know, it's if you look at it, it's interesting. The one issue that most clearly divides conservatives from liberals is the issue of gun control. Not taxes, not abortion, not any other type of regulation that you can look at. Gun control, by far, is the issue that most separates self-identified liberals and conservatives.
Well, to me, the First Amendment gives us the freedom, guarantees us the freedom of religion, freedom of speech, freedom of the press, freedom to peaceably assemble, and freedom to petition for redress of grievances. And the Second Amendment guarantees the First Amendment.
Amen to that. Hey, we're just about out of time.
Well, thank you for being there, Dr. Stan, and I want to thank your guests, and keep up the good work.
We will. God bless you. Bye-bye. Okay, fine. That was Ron calling in from Washington. Well, we're just about out of time. Do you have any parting thoughts for our listeners this evening, other than they ought to get the book, The Bias Against Guns?
I appreciate the plug there. I think it's important if we're going to change this debate before it's too late for people to kind of understand why so many people have this fear and why it's that fear is unjustified. The reason why I wrote the book was I've done a lot of research on guns over the years, and I've just kind of run into people who say, well, I've never heard of this defensive gun use. And it kind of, and to see the huge gap between people's perceptions and what the research shows. And so in writing the book, I basically wrote it along the way that I kind of found talking to people over time to get them to reconsider these biases, because I found the most effective way to get people to reconsider their strong anti-gun feelings is to get them to face how they got that impression to begin with. Because if you can chip away, if you can go and convince them that maybe they didn't get the full story, I think you can make a real difference there. Just giving them some numbers and facts, while it's important, and that's something that one also has to do, and I try to provide those. You have to take into account it's against this backdrop of 30, 40 years of a constant drumbeat that we've been hearing about just the bad things that happen with guns as opposed to the benefits, and that's a difficult sale. And so you have to begin to get them to question how they came to the view and whether or not they can really trust the media and the government to give them accurate information on it.
Well, I want to thank you so very much, first of all, for your research, secondly, for writing your books, and thirdly, for being with us three occasions recently. I really appreciate it, and I hope my audiences all begin to better understand how our reality is shaped by what we read in the newspaper and magazines, what we see on television, what we hear on radio, that very often plays on the emotions but has very little basis in reality. Thank you so very much for being with us tonight.
Well, I really appreciate you having me on three times. It shows, I take that as a strong compliment.
Well, they're all different audiences, which is a great thing, and so you've talked to a lot of different people in different parts of the country.
Well, I appreciate you doing it anyway.
Good night, and God bless you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. And let me just point out, somebody was on a program today, we were talking about republics and democracies, and somebody said, what's the difference between a republic and a democracy? And I said, well, in a democracy, you have two wolves negotiating with the sheep on what they're going to have for dinner. In a republic, you have laws against eating sheep, and every sheep is armed. And of course, it's a superficial approach, but there's a lot of truth to that. Free people are armed. People who are enslaved are not. Did you notice that it wasn't until Saddam Hussein's regime was very, very severely threatened that he would allow the people at all to have weapons? He kept his power because he had the weapons and the people did not. And, of course, this is exactly what is intended. There really are people who would like to have a dictatorship in what was once the land of the free and the home of the brave. They don't believe in the Constitution. They believe in a ruling elite. They believe that only the elite should be armed, the congressmen, the Rosie O'Donnells, the Senator Feinstein and Senator Boxer. But for us common folks, oh, no, no, because, of course, they're not worried about the children. They're worried about opposition to their power. Well, this is the time we have to remind you Radio Liberty is listener-supported. If you're out there across America listening to us, we hope many of you will decide right now you're going to join the Radio Liberty family of supporters. And, of course, you can do that by calling us at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. If you'd like a free copy of our latest newsletter, which really goes into the little group of people who control the President of the United States. They're called the Project for the New American Century, or neocons, and we will give you the material from their website, what they say about the importance of going to war with Iraq. And they started this plan in 1997, long before President Bush was elected. If you'd like a free copy of the March newsletter, give us a call at 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. Pray for America. Pray for our leaders. Pray for our ministers. And pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection. And so until tomorrow at the same time, Dr. Stan, good night, and may the Lord be with you. Good evening, Dr. Stan, here at Radio Liberty. coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you, the views that are expressed here are not those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views. The views of our guests, the views of our callers, we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being, because we have with us on the line from Jackson, Mississippi, Dr. Russell Blaylock. Russell, thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Well, thank you, Dr. Stan. I appreciate it.
Well, it's getting a little late back there, isn't it?
Yep, 11 o'clock.
Okay, fine. Well, Dr. Blaylock's written a couple of books we carry. One is Excitotoxin, The Taste That Kills. It's the story of MSG, aspartame, and the fact that they snuck this in through the FDA, a very toxic substance that has a real impact on the brain and actually has a destructive component. But then, of course, his second book, which we've been carrying, it's just been, well, probably the most popular book we've ever had, called Health and Nutrition Secrets That Can Save Your Life. And it has a section there on how to, of course, try to build up your immunity. And this, of course, is the most important thing you could do if there were to be a biological attack on America. But I thought we'd start out tonight talking about something, a phenomenon. And we really didn't hear about it until about a month ago. It was something called SARS, severe acute respiratory syndrome?
It stands for severe acute respiratory syndrome.
Severe acute respiratory syndrome, SARS. And of course, we've got a name for it, but it's something that's very, very unique because it produces a pneumonia in about, well, in a significant percentage of the patients, somewhere between 3-4% of the people, die. But the significance of this is it's highly contagious, and many of the doctors and nurses who've taken care of SARS patients have themselves become infected, and it's, of course, it started out in China, and then it spread to Hong Kong and to Singapore, and then, of course, there were cases up in Toronto, and I've forgotten whether they had 80 or 180 cases, but they had 10 deaths up in Toronto. And you wouldn't think about, you know, here in a highly, a civilized place like Toronto, you would have such a tremendous mortality. And so I've asked Dr. Blaylock to come on and tell us his impression of what is this? Where did this come from? And we hear all these stories, oh, it came from chickens and it went to pigs and then it went to humans, but they don't know where it came from, or do they?
Well, there's evidence that this is a bioweapon. They're not saying that officially, but I'll read to you from World Health Organization, which is handling this. The American CDC recommends that you go to their site to find information. And their epidemiologist, Klaus Storr, made this statement. He said, "This virus is unlike any known human or animal member of this virus family. So it's completely unique. It's a member of the coronavirus family." Now, coronaviruses is basically what causes colds. The virus almost never gets into the lungs. It always stays as a head cold. There's never been a reported fatality from coronavirus infection. So this is something brand new, that you would have a 3-4% mortality and such severe illness, and illness that affects primarily the lungs themselves associated with this particular virus, which gives a strong indication that it's been bioengineered. The other thing is that the first reported case was in November in Hanoi, in a hospital in Hanoi, Vietnam. Then the workers became infected that dealt with the case, and every case that was reported in Vietnam, which is something like 64 cases, all of the people were in contact directly with the nursing staff or medical staff that took care of this one individual. Now, since that time, they traced that back, and apparently this individual came from China, in the Guangdong province, and it was from a particular hotel in that province, and ironically, they've traced it to room 911 in the hotel. So everyone who's contracted the illness, they can trace back to that hotel and ultimately back to that room.
And who was in room 911 in the Guangdong, at the hotel in Guangdong?
Well, they're not really absolutely sure, but it appears to be a 64-year-old professor of nephrology, which is an expert in kidney diseases, seemed to be the first case that could be traced to that 9/11 room on the ninth floor of the Metropole Hotel. There's also a 48-year-old American businessman who was in the same hotel, and he came down with it and died. So, you know, we have a single location and a single room of a hotel in which all these cases are being traced. That's very suspicious for a bioengineered and released organism. And then our virologists have typed and carefully examined this virus and said that it does not occur in nature, either in animals or in humans. And the particular thing about the coronavirus is it does not transfer from animals to humans. There's a human form and there's an animal form, and they don't cross between each other. So that also makes it very suspicious.
Well, you know, there's something, I talked to Dr. Garth Nicholson. I don't know, do you know Dr. Nicholson? Do you know who he is?
Yes.
All right, well, I talked to him yesterday, and I said, you know, what's your take on this? And he said, well, you know, first of all, the latest information on this is that there is not only the coronavirus, but there is a component of chlamydia that is, seems to be grafted onto this. And pardon me, I had to sneeze there, and I didn't want to sneeze in the microphone. You know, that, and he said, you know, this is really very suspicious that this could be a man-made virus. And now, apparently, this type of pneumonia that they had, the initial impression, you know, with the people that really understand a lot of these things, was that maybe this was a mycoplasm type of pneumonia. And, of course, but then when they were actually able to check the virus out, and I don't know who's done that, he's sending me the article, but apparently, you know, here are parts of the chlamydia, which is a sort of bacteria, which is part of this virus. So you've got both a bacterial and a viral disease in this one virus. And that just doesn't occur.
Right, and the chlamydia can cause a pneumonia, so this would be a reason why this virus suddenly is causing pneumonias. But it's, you know, it varies in the young people when we look at their chest x-rays. Like most coronaviruses, the incubation period's about 3 to 5 days. But they can go through the whole illness and their chest x-rays stay essentially normal, whereas an older person or people living in China which have poor nutrition, when we look at their chest x-rays, you can have severe changes and even consolidation and full-blown pneumonia, and that's what's killing them.
Well, you know, this is really a rather frightening thing to think that, you know, suddenly here in the 21st century, we're having an entirely new disease that is highly contagious. I will say that the World Health Organization has done a pretty good job of at least getting the instructions out, and it's how vitally important it is that the people who, of course, have the disease, you know, wear face masks. But, you know, certainly wouldn't want to come in contact with anybody who had the disease unless you were fully gowned and gloved and had a face mask and were very careful as far as your personal hygiene and washing hands, because this is a potentially lethal disease. Now, they say, oh, well, it's only 3 to 4%, and, you know, West Nile virus is, you know, 5 to 10%, and, you know, you get up to Ebola, that's 30 to 80%. This is, you know, not none of those are, well, of course, Ebola can be transmitted from person to person, but West Nile virus has to go through a mosquito. But here's something that spreads just like a common cold, highly contagious. When you stop and think of the number of healthcare providers that have already contracted the disease.
Well, the other thing that's frightening about coronaviruses is that they produce chronic infections. And it's one of the viruses that can enter the brain and stay there for a lifetime. There's been some studies that indicate that the coronavirus may be closely linked to multiple sclerosis. And studies have been done on multiple sclerosis victims, and they find out that a large percentage of them do indeed harbor this coronavirus within the nerve tissue, those lesions in their brain and peripheral nervous system. So this virus is one that can produce long-term neurological problems, and this is appeared in November, so we really haven't had a chance to see what kind of long-term neurological problems we're going to have in the people that were infected.
Well, the other thing is, of course, that although they've had a fair number of cases in America, has anybody died here yet so far?
There's been no deaths in the United States.
All right. And that's a little strange, you know. If you're going to have 10 deaths up in Toronto, which is certainly a first world country, although I think some of these were people from the Orient, but they were probably people, you know, who was very, you know, probably very westernized, you know, and the fact that we've had no deaths here so far, and of course they've had 10 deaths up there, you know, gives you pause for concern. Everything we say tonight is simply conjecture. But are there people who actually would actually produce genetically engineered diseases? Well, for our skeptic out there, let me once again refer to something we've talked about many times, a website called thenewamericancentury.org, www.newamericancentury.org. And one of the suggestions that they were making about the new types of warfare was talking about genetically engineered diseases, and not only genetically engineered diseases to use against the enemy, but genetically engineered diseases which would be type specific for certain races. In other words, you could eliminate certain races with these. What sort of human beings are these who are planning on using disease to eliminate races? You've got to get hold of that report and read it to understand that this is people like, well, who makes up this little group from the Project for the New American Century? Dick Cheney, Donald Rumsfeld, John Boland, Paul Wolfowitz, and go to the website, find out who the people are. You'll see them on television all the time, each one verifying the others. I get a fax every day from one of these people, which is following the PNAC line, Project for the New American Century. And of course, you know, they are manipulating the Christian community to go along with this agenda. But these are people, and in their report, Rebuilding America's Defenses, they talk about the ability to create new diseases, biologically engineer them, that will, of course, be race-specific. So there really are evil and wicked people out there, and this is very disconcerting, especially when such evil and wicked people seem to hold the reins of power in our nation today. You know, one of the things that impresses me, Russell, is that, you know, when I'm reading these articles, you know, and they always say, well, you know, probably the reason that this came from China is there's so many people in China. And there's so many chickens and ducks in China. And probably this disease started with a chicken or duck, and then it went into a pig, and then it went into a human being. And I'm reading this, and I'm saying, they must think we're awfully stupid. Did you have that impression reading about this?
Yeah, because as I said, it's known that the coronavirus does not jump species. We don't develop the coronavirus species from animals. It can only be transmitted to other humans. So we know that that's not true. It's never occurred in nature. And as I read the epidemiologists and virologists that studied this particular virus, that there's no virus like it anywhere in animals or in humans. So this virus, all the indications indicate that it was genetically engineered and created.
Why would they do such a thing at this time in history and release it at this time in history?
Well, it's, you know, something that remains to be seen. Of course, you know, we have so many groups that want to use these things, and you have to realize that, or at least the audience does, that we have people in China, the Communist Party of China, who have a big interest in population destruction. We have people in Russia who, of course, are interested still in the destruction of the West. We have people embedded in our government that are have been in close cooperation with these KGB, GRU-type people in the old Soviet Union, still have the same plans. And then, of course, as you trace it back, as you have, we go to people in the Bilderberger and the Trilateral Commission and CFR who also have these ideas and sort of hide in the shadows and engineer these things and allow them to happen. So there are people out there who either population control or political control or economic control or all of the above can use these viruses for political and international purposes.
Well, I think it's a frightening thing to contemplate. But, you know, Chris, then this gets us back to what you have written about in your book, you know, about how we build up our immunity. And, of course, the first thing we hear, they say, oh, we're going to come up with a vaccine. Well, they may or they may not come up with a vaccine. Of course, many of these vaccines have had really terrible complications. And, you know, certainly the mercury that they put in the vaccines through the years. And then, of course, we know about the terrible mistake they made when they came out with the polio vaccine by including a cancer virus. And 90 million Americans got cancer viruses from the original Sabin vaccine. And then they changed it over, you know, into a different type of monkey. They were growing the vaccine. And then we all got the monkey cytomegalic viruses. And, you know, and of course, they've never been forthright with the public. We know in the Philippines and Kenya, they put in contraceptive material, use vaccines to prevent women from getting pregnant without their knowledge or consent. So I don't feel very happy with the thought of taking vaccines because I don't know that we can trust the vaccine manufacturers or even many people in the public health service who know what was going on and, of course, did not want the public to know.
Well, I think you're exactly right, I know many physicians that refuse to take the smallpox vaccine, and of course, since they've been giving it to healthcare workers, we've had two cases of death from cardiac damage. So we know that the immune reaction is killing some people, and of course, it's a live virus. And my review of the vaccine problem and virology indicates that I would never take a live virus vaccine. And many of your vaccines are live viruses. And the reason is because new evidence indicates that these attenuated viruses, and what they do is they pass them through different cultures or different cells, the virus begins to lose its ability to cause disease and becomes benign. But what we're discovering now is that once you inoculate somebody with a live virus, that virus stays in their body for a lifetime. And because their bodies are generating free radicals at different rates throughout their life, these free radicals can reactivate these viruses, mutate them, so that they become pathogenic, that is, they can cause diseases. Well, we also know it can change the virus so that it causes different diseases than it did originally. So there's evidence that with all this inoculation of people with these live viruses, we're producing a terrible situation in future generations, and some of these viruses are passed on to the offspring. We know these viruses implant in brain cells, and they stay there for a lifetime and can reconvert, produce neurological diseases. We know that there's even cases have been shown, proven, of live viruses causing Parkinson's disease in young children. It may be one of the causes of Alzheimer's disease. So injecting live viruses is a very dangerous situation. With this insanity of giving chickenpox virus to children, my friends that are infectious disease are absolutely baffled. There's just no reason to ever give a chickenpox vaccine.
You know, that is really, we have the CDC latest VAERS report. That's the adverse reaction report, and that is the most toxic vaccine there's ever been. There's so many more toxic reactions to that chickenpox vaccine, and yet, you know, they're mandating that in states all across this country. Big money, big pressure is being put on to mandate a vaccine you don't need, and secondly, one that has more reactions than any other vaccine that we've ever had.
That's right, and many of these reactions are neurological. We're finding everything from Bell's palsy to encephalitis to paralysis to convulsions, autoimmune diseases of all kinds. So we're seeing numerous serious neurological conditions in people who receive the chickenpox vaccine.
And now, is this a live virus?
It's a live virus.
Okay. Well, I mean, this is totally ridiculous. And let me advise you, if you're out there in the listening audience, do not let your children take either hepatitis B or the chickenpox vaccine. I mean, this is just, this is, well, I think it's criminal, actually, that they're pushing this today, and I've lost all respect for the CDC and the Public Health Service that goes along with this for political purposes.
Well, and the other vaccine is this hepatitis B vaccine for children. The infectious disease people say it's just an absolute absurdity that in the United States of America, they're giving a hepatitis B vaccine to children. It's not a significant risk in American children unless your mother happens to be a drug user or an HIV victim. Your risk of your child developing hepatitis B is almost zero. Yet they have them convinced that every child needs this hepatitis B vaccine first at birth, and now they realize how stupid that was, so they let them wait a few months before they give the vaccine. But we've reached a point of insanity, and what it amounts to on the obvious scale is they're making a ton of money off of these vaccines, and that's why they're in cahoots with the CDC and the various medical societies to promote vaccination. It's not for public health. It's destroying public health. It's to make money. Recently, there was a report that came out in all the newspapers and media in the United States of an article reported in the New England Journal of Medicine saying that they did this study and found out that people who had the flu shot had a dramatic reduction in mortality and heart attacks and strokes, and that this is even a stronger indication for everybody to run and get their flu shot for everybody over age 50. Well, I read that article and reviewed it. Number one, this period of examination was 1 year, which is hardly anything to see the effects of mortality from heart attacks and strokes and long-term mortality in a year study. That's laughable. But then when you read at the end of the article who funded this, it was funded by the vaccine board. So the people who are benefiting from vaccines are the people who funded this study to be done and printed in the New England Journal of Medicine. No mention was made of the thimerosal that's still in the flu vaccine, so that the elderly are getting a dose of mercury every time they get an injection. And the fact that a lot of the elderly, the reason they get the flu every year and are at risk is because they have immune suppression that's nutritional-based. So if they improve their nutrition with specific supplementation of nutrients, they'll have the immunity they had when they were 25, 30 years of age, and they won't need a flu shot. But they don't want them to know that, even though the research is very firm and is proven in the medical literature in numerous studies. It's just that simple. You can take few selected supplements, and elderly can have an immune system just as powerful as a 25-year-old person.
And, of course, the other thing is, of course, if you are taking the vaccine, it's not going to work as well, you know, if you don't have a good immune system. And if you have a good immune system, you don't need the vaccine.
Right, and a lot of people, what happens if they're elderly and they have an impaired immune system and you vaccinate them, that's the very people who have the most reactions. They're more likely to develop paralysis, seizures, encephalitis, multiple sclerosis. All of these serious reactions are infinitely more common in the elderly who have immune suppression. The other thing they're recommending to the elderly who have poor hearts and have all of these medical conditions, yet if you look at the immunological literature, they tell you that's the very people who shouldn't be getting these vaccines because they have impaired immune systems. The only reason you see people improve at all with the vaccinations is because the people who have moderately or well nutritious states, if you immunize them, it boosts their immunity, and of course they get a little healthier. The real danger is the people who have poor immunity. In other words, those at most risk from flu anyway, they're going to be worse off.
Well, you know, before we get away from hepatitis B, I just want to mention one of the most amazing statistics I ever saw. And that is that in the mainland China, where there are 1.25 billion people, there are 700 million people who've been infected with hepatitis B. 120 million still are active carriers of hepatitis B. And, of course, then they're, of course, giving all these people the hepatitis B shots, because there would certainly be some justification for giving it to children at birth. If you didn't know whether mother was positive or not, there'd be a good chance that she was positive. But how did you get that much hepatitis B in the Chinese population? Why, you were giving them injections with dirty needles. Now, how could you do something that stupid? There are 200 million people in the world with hepatitis C, and most of them got it from vaccinations with dirty needles, using them over and over again. How could you be that stupid? Recent studies out of Africa suggest that much of the HIV disease is there, comes from injections with dirty needles. And, of course, everybody's saying that isn't true, but the article's been peer-reviewed and published in at least three different journals. Now, why would anybody, I mean, needles cost you one or two cents each. Why would you do something that stupid, you know, when all the disease you're going to create could be prevented by 2 cents for a new needle? Why would you do anything like that unintentionally? And I don't think there would be any reason. These people are not stupid in China, nor in Africa. Certainly we are there supervising what's going on. Why doesn't the World Health Organization say, hey, maybe you ought to use either new needles or sterilize the needles in between times? And they're just not doing it. And I believe that there is a genocidal policy out there. But let's get back to your basic contention to build up immunity. And maybe we could talk a little bit about what should people be doing to increase their immunity.
Well, what I did in the book and in a special pamphlet I put together for Protection Against Bioterrorism is I looked at world epidemics historically, and then I looked at the modern literature of what we know about infections. And what we discover is that as people begin to age, they begin to lose a lot of their immune power. So that when you reach about 45, 50 years of age, your immunity is substantially decreased. When you reach 60, 70, it can be quite severely decreased. That's the discovery of why that happens. It's not due to the fact that you're aging. It's due to the fact that your nutrition is so poor. And they found that if they took a large group of elderly and they fed them one or two vitamins, that their immunity suddenly was significantly increased, and that they rarely had infections. And if they developed flu infections or other viral infections, they recovered from them very rapidly. So the what we call age-related immune suppression is purely nutritional. But, of course, the vaccine people don't want you to know that, because then that put them out of business. Now, I went a step further and said, well, if you want to really make the immune system powerful, then you can use what we call nonspecific immune stimulation. And we know there's a lag time between the time you're exposed to a virus, let's say the SARS virus. When you're exposed to that virus, what happens in your body is the virus enters the body through the lung tissue and the nasal passages. Then it has to start multiplying and growing. Now, in order for you to protect yourself against that infection, your internal immune system has to, number one, send cells to the virus, recognize the virus, bring it back to the immune cells that plan the attack, and they have to gear up. And then they go and attack the virus. Well, there's a lag time there of about several days to even a week, depending on the state of your immune system, before you can build up enough immune cells and get this attack coordinated. Now, what nutrition does, and what this non-specific stimulation of the immune system does, is it significantly shortens that lag time, so your immune system is always ready to go on attack. There's no period that it has to be woken up, so that the instant these few little viral particles enter, the immune system can immediately attack them and eliminate them.
I'm going to have to interrupt you there because I don't want to get this information out. We got to go to the half-hour break. This is Dr. Stan here, and our guest this evening is Dr. Russell Blaylock. Our telephone number, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, that's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or 464-8295. If you'd like to give us a call, a question, a comment, why, we'll welcome your calls. And Dr. Blaylock is talking about how the immune system works and how, of course, you want to speed up this reaction as the cells go out, sense the virus's presence, and then go back to begin to get the immune system to begin to plan to launch an attack. So why don't you pick up the story from there?
So basically what we want to do is we want to shorten that time so that the immune system can react very rapidly and we don't have to wait for it to suddenly be woken up and all these mechanisms take effect. Well, we find out that if you take people and animals, any species, and you give them what's called beta-glucan, the beta-glucan activates the cells in the immune system that do all of the planning so that those cells are always ready. They don't have to be woken up and put into activity. So that the second that a virus enters your system, these immune cells can immediately launch their attack. And what they do is they stimulate the cells that primarily respond for getting rid of viruses and bacteria and funguses. These are called the natural killer cells, the T lymphocytes, and the phagocytes, the neutrophils. The beta-glucan dramatically increases the ability of these cells to kill viruses and to react very rapidly. For instance, just neutrophils gobbling up viruses and bacteria, if you use beta-glucan, it increases that 20 to 50 fold. Hmm. So you get a dramatic increase in the ability of your immune system to kill these things. One of the effects, for instance, of anthrax, is it secretes a toxin called the lethal toxin, which inhibits those cells so that they can't react. But the beta-glucan can override that so they can get rid of the anthrax. And it has been tested on anthrax and found to dramatically improve survival of those exposed to anthrax. Now, what I do is I combine all of this together. I use the beta-glucan is the primary immune activator, and that's not immune stimulant. It's a immune modulator. That means it keeps your immune system on high activity alert without actually overstimulating your immune system. Then you want to replace all of the different vitamins and minerals that the immune system uses, because when you produce a lot of cells to get rid of these viruses, you have to produce trillions of them. That takes a lot of the B vitamins, the C vitamins in particular. So you give a high dose of the vitamin C, the vitamin multivitamins of the B group, B1, thiamine, riboflavin, pyridoxine. All of these B vitamins are used for this. Then you want to use the vitamin E. We know that if people have poor immunity, you can give them vitamin E, and it boosts these same types of cells, makes them work a lot better. Selenium is a powerful immune stimulant, particularly that part of the immunity that fights viruses and bacteria. A substance called N-acetyl-L-cysteine does the same thing. We find that people who have flu, if you give them N-acetyl-L-cysteine, it dramatically reduces the symptoms and they get over it much quicker. Also, it protects the body against the damaging effects of these infections. Garlic is a very powerful antibacterial, antifungal, and antiviral. During World War I, typhus killed millions and millions of people in Europe during the war. And we found out that the soldiers who were chewing on cloves of garlic every day rarely got typhus. And that's because it actually is such a powerful antibiotic. But the interesting thing about garlic extract is bacteria can never develop resistance to it like they can antibiotics. And I recommend magnesium because we know magnesium, number one, acts as an anti-inflammatory, reduces free radical damage, and it protects the cells against all the damaging effects of viruses and this immune attack. The vitamin A, particularly as beta-carotene and the various carotenoids like alpha-carotene and lutein, zeaxanthin, these carotenoid substances also powerfully stimulate immunity. And that was the part of the vitamin mixture that was particularly good at restoring age-related immune loss. So mixing all of these different nutritional factors together, we find that you can dramatically improve people's immunity. And one of the first things I hear from patients that I put the put on this mixture is that they'll say, well, I never get colds anymore. I never get sick. So that's a universal thing, that number one, you rarely get sick. If you do get sick, you get over it very quickly. So I think anyone who's going to fly anywhere, be on a plane, particularly a transcontinental flight, should take beta carotene, should take these vitamins before they leave, and they should take them each day during their trip. That would dramatically reduce the risk of you developing this SARS virus infection, and if you had it, you're most likely going to survive with very few problems.
Well, now, how do you get the beta glucans?
Well, the beta glucan, there's several different companies that make them. One is called ImmuCell, which you can get through the website, but it is a very highly purified form of beta glucan. Beta glucan is extracted from the cell wall of yeast, and it has to be highly purified because if it's contaminated with a protein in the yeast wall, it can produce some severe immune reactions. So this company is known for its high purification, so there's no contamination.
You call it again, ImmuCell?
ImmuCell. You can get it from www.sourcenaturals.com. That's SourceNaturals. That's the place that I found that you can get the highest purity. Another company called MacroForce makes a product called MacroForce. Also makes a highly purified form of beta glucan. It's not quite as powerful as the ImmuCell form, but it's highly purified as well. They're both good products.
All right, fine. And then, of course, where would you get this? You call it N-acetylcysteine, was that it?
Right, N-acetylcysteine. You can find that in most health food stores.
Now, what is that? That's basically an essential amino acid?
It's composed partially of an amino acid cysteine, but it has an acetyl group on it that keeps the cysteine from being toxic, because if you just took pure cysteine, it's an excitotoxin. But by making N-acetyl-L-cysteine, it protects the cells, it goes inside of the cell, and then it's released, and that way it doesn't cause any problem. Cysteine in your cells is converted to glutathione, which is one of the most powerful antioxidants in the cell. We know people that have low glutathione have the highest cancer rate. People that have low glutathione have the highest disease rate, or infection rate. So that's probably why it works so well. It also protects you against mercury toxicity as well, so there's a lot of advantage to N-acetyl-L-cysteine.
All right, fine. So basically then it's the vitamins, the B, C, E, and A, of course, and then, of course, your selenium, what about zinc?
Zinc is very important for several reasons. Number one, zinc is will stimulate cellular-type immunity, but it also strengthens what we call connective tissue, and that's all the tissue that holds everything together, cells and skin and such. And that acts as a physical barrier to invasion by bacteria. So that's important. So does vitamin C. And when you combine zinc and selenium and vitamin C, you get a very good, powerful mixture to stimulate immunity.
Well, is there any one product that will do this whole thing? You know, we got about five or six different, eight different things here. Is there any one product that people could be taking or should be taking that you think of?
I don't know one product that has everything. The closest would be a product called ExtendCore Multivitamin Minerals, which is made by Vitamin Research Products. You can find it on the Internet. That company makes a product that has the selenium and the B vitamins and the C and the E. And it's kind of all mixed together, plus your minerals. It doesn't have the N-acetyl-L-cysteine in it. It doesn't have garlic. But it has the vitamin A and all the different beta carotenes that you would need. It doesn't have the high enough dose of the magnesium. But if you were going to take one capsule you know, rather than all these things separately, that would probably be the best way to take it.
All right, because, you know, from a practical point of view, especially if you've got older people, they're not going to take about six to eight different medicines. You need something to tell them to take, give them the best possible thing, and maybe they can take one or two other supplements. But,
right.
You know, you just from a purely practical point of view, it's too bad that nobody's put all of these things together.
Well, it's because of the volume of them. Once you start putting the right doses, the right amounts, and putting them all together, you end up with numerous capsules. You just can't fit it all in one capsule, so that's why it ends up that way. But the magnesium is very important for protecting the heart, particularly against heart attacks and strokes, and protects the brain. Very powerful brain protectant. The beta-glucan is something you're not going to take every day, but, you know, when you're exposed to a virus or if you hear about a bioterrorism attack or you're going to take a flight, you want to take your beta-glucan at that time.
Now, how about something like echinacea?
Well, the problem with echinacea is that it stimulates both forms of immunity, what we call humoral immunity, which is your antibodies, and it stimulates cellular immunity, which is the type that fights viruses. The problem is that can cause autoimmunity. If you have autoimmunity, it makes you worse. For instance, if you have lupus or MS, it makes you a lot worse. And it only works for a short period of time, and then the effect tends to die off. So I don't recommend things like echinacea. I would use only beta-glucan as an immune stimulant.
Well, no, there's something that they call airborne. People take this when they're going to take a flight. Do you know anything at all about that product?
Not specifically, but a lot of those products they sell like that have echinacea in it, and they'll have some other herbal immune stimulants, astragalus or something like that mixed with it. Again, that's a broad-spectrum immune stimulant, and you can get some problems with it, particularly if they're not pure. If they have contaminant proteins in it, can produce some bad immune reactions.
Okay.
So I would be careful with those.
All right, fine. Well, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Our guest is Dr. Russell Blaylock. We're talking about how do you prepare if there were to be a biological attack. Perhaps there already is a biological attack. It's really very interesting, you know, that air traffic to the Orient is just about falling off. Certainly, Air Canada, which has been going over there, suddenly has gone into bankruptcy. They've canceled all their flights to the Orient. Certainly, many of the other carriers have been going to the Orient are cutting this off. And, of course, people are really frightened, and I think with good justification.
Well, I would agree. You know, as I say, that it's not just surviving the respiratory part of the infection, but as I said, coronavirus tends to implant itself in the brain cells and nervous system cells and can produce neurological disease years later. So I certainly wouldn't want to get infected with whatever this bioterrorism agent is.
All right, fine. And, of course, you know, they're talking about, of course, this is going to have such a profound impact on the economy of China, certainly of the tourist industry, apparently in Hong Kong, where, you know, things have just been booming. Even, you know, with all the things going on in the world, Hong Kong's been booming until, you know, about the last month. And now you can go into the restaurants where before, you know, it was waiting room only or standing room only, and there's just nobody there. And, you know, it's amazing the fear that something like this can engender. And, of course, we've got the fear of the war. Now we've got the fear of SARS. And yet, of course, I think that this fear is really very well justified. An entirely new virus that has never been seen before with some strong implications that this may be a bioengineered virus. Now,
I agree that, you know, the economic impact is going to be one of the worst things to the SARS virus. It's going to be of an immediate onset. It's going to cost billions and billions of dollars, and a lot of people are going to go bankrupt. And I worry about the long-term neurological effects of this virus as well.
All right, Chris, we really won't know for some time, but let's see what we have coming on the line. Oh, we've got Nathan calling in. Hi, Nathan. Did you have a question or comment?
Good evening, Doctor. How are you doing tonight?
Fine.
Good. You know, you really raised a red flag because you raised the issue of SARS and you raised the issue of population control and you put them together. it's something that's been in the back of my mind ever since this whole thing began, although obviously I don't have the facts on it. But Dr. Blaylock mentioned before that he felt that there were people here who were in league with people in the communist or the Stalinist, let's say, world, and that they both had the intention to reduce population. Did I gather your views correctly?
Right.
My question, though, is why would they specifically have targeted China at this time? If that's true, why would the Chinese communist butchers deliberately target what would presumably be their own economy that they would need to rise to world preeminence?
Well, it's affecting the Western economy more than their own economy, for one thing. The other thing is they've got a lot of population that costs them a lot of money, and they would love to get rid of them. You know, they have the abortion policy. They have the allowing only two children policy. So there's policies in China geared at dramatically reducing their population. This would be certainly a good way to do it, because the victims that would die from this virus are going to be those that are the poorest, those that have the worst nutrition, in other words, those who contribute the least to the Chinese society. The other thing is most of these international flights are certainly going to be devastated by it, and it's bringing it to the West. This was one way to introduce it into the West and make it look like a spontaneously occurring virus. They know that the Bush administration or any presidential administration would not want to announce that this is a bioterrorism agent, because it would just horrify the world. So they want to act like this is something that occurred in nature. But if it does become an epidemic in the United States, of course the economic impact in the United States can be enormous. And already Tommy Thompson's talking about activating the quarantine rule, the Section 361 of the Public Health Service Act, and that gives the federal government as well as the states the right to quarantine anybody they want to for any length of time they would want to. So the political implications destruction of the West, which has always been the aim of the Soviets and the Chinese communists, are enormous. A very easy way for them to do it. It would have some economic impact in China, but nowhere near what it's going to impact us.
And let me mention, Nathan, that there's about 150 million people that are in the rural areas and the farms that they don't need there to produce food. And they don't have the jobs for these people. What are they going to do with 150 million people they don't have jobs for? How are they going to feed them? Well, what do you think they would be at all adverse to killing off a large number of those? You know, during the period between 1959 and 1962, they had something called the Great Hunger. And, of course, there's a book written about that, never mentioned in America. They killed off 44.5 million Chinese, starved them to death by when they collectivized the farms. Now, that was never mentioned in the United States. The book is Hungry Ghosts, and I think it's still available on Amazon.com. I recommend that everybody get it and read it and understand that 44.5 million people were starved to death in communist China, and it never once made it into the American newspapers. See, how do you think that happened?
Yeah, I read that book, and it's one of the most horrifying books I've ever read. I've read all the Soviet books about the Ukraine, etc., but The Hungry Ghost is something you'll never forget. And this was a purposeful policy of the Chinese communist government to destroy these people. And the 44 million number is considered a conservative number. It may be as high as 100 million. But the very thought of purposely destroying the lives of 100 million people or 44 million people by starving them to death is just unbelievable. I mean, certainly is shocking, even comparing to Hitler.
I'll take my answer off the line and let you gentlemen continue. But do you gentlemen believe that the Malthusians, that the Chinese, if this is true, and the Chinese are operating under the philosophy of Malthus, do you believe that they're then operating in tandem with the other Malthusians who are the broader globalist Malthusians. I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
All right, fine. Of course, for our listener out there, Malthus was actually an Anglican minister who was writing somewhere the latter part of the 1700s, very early part of the 1800s, as I remember. And of course, he said that there's just too many people in the world. The population increases exponentially, and the agricultural increases at a much lower rate, and so we've just got to get rid of a lot of the people. He advocated building cities next to stagnant ponds, discouraging cleanliness, and certainly never encourage anybody to stop a major epidemic. He believed that we had to kill off large parts of the population. And, of course, he has his disciples today within Planned Parenthood, the population control people. But, of course, Nathan's question to you, Dr. Blaylock, was, do you think that the Chinese communist Malthusians are working with the Malthusians here in the West?
Yeah, I do. You know, the Malthusian idea, as you said, from Thomas Malthus was a way to kill off a large number of the population. And we've seen quotes from many of these groups. Some of them portray themselves like the PETA, the animal rights organizations, and they make statements that we need to kill 2/3 of the population of the earth, and you know, some say even more than that, 3/4 of the population of the earth, to make room for the animals and make life better. So, you know, this is things that are seriously being considered. We've had conferences in the UN that also have promoted this Malthusian idea. In the UN, the Chinese communists participate in these conferences, and the Russians participate, as well as Western Malthusians. So I think, yes, they all carry the same idea. They work in tandem, they work together, and these things happen.
And I agree with you totally. And for anybody out there who doubts that there really is a plan, there really are people that like to kill off most of the world's population, let me suggest the UNESCO Courier, November of 1991. The article by Jacques Cousteau, who said we've got to kill off or eliminate 350,000 people a day. It's a terrible thing to say, but we're going to have to eliminate 350,000 people a day now. We've made that offer many times. If you would like to have a copy of that article, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927 and ask a request of Jacques Cousteau article. We have it in both English and French. And, of course, he said this. Why wasn't this on the front page of the New York Times condemning him? Why, after all, you know, in about a month, he'd kill more people than Hitler did, you know, more than the Jews were killed in the concentration camps. So why isn't Jacques Cousteau condemned? Because, of course, many of the people who control our media agree with him. And all you need to do is go to Elberton, Georgia, to see the Georgia Guidestones. And they're engraved in stone in Elberton, just outside the city of Elberton, just a little northeast of that, is the Georgia Guidestones. And the Ten Commandments from the dark side, number one is maintain the Earth population at 500 million in constant balance with nature. Well, if you consider that there are over 6 billion people in the world, if you're going to maintain the world population at 500 million, you're going to have to kill off over 90% of the world's population. Are there any people who believe that? You go to my website, radioliberty.com, pull down my Population Control Agenda monograph and read it, and I think you'll be convinced that there really are people that advocate this openly, intentionally. In fact, it was Prince Philip, Prince Charles's father, who said when he died, he hoped he'd come back as a virus and he could help then the control of the world population. In other words, by infecting them and killing them. Yes, there really are people out there who believe that way. But of course, we don't want the American people to know that. They might begin to suspect what the future holds. Well, we've just got a couple of minutes more before we will conclude the program. Are there any other things that you'd like to bring up that you think would be important for our listeners to hear tonight?
Well, I think they, you know, as you said, that there's a lot of things that go on in the shadows. They need to not just pay attention to the major news sources. They need to do some study and look into some of these areas of these nefarious plans that have been proposed, that are in print, They're well known among these inner circles. All you have to do is read them, and you'll convince yourself that it's true. And you need to prepare, and this is the way you can prepare, is by nonspecific immune stimulation. You can protect yourself and your family against many of these things. Even Ebola, the mortality is dramatically reduced by nonspecific immune stimulation. High death rates are in Africans that have very poor nutrition.
Has that actually ever been proven? Is this just a supposition that if you have good nutrition, you won't be so susceptible to the Ebola?
Well, we know this is a universal finding with all known viruses, even the most lethal of the viruses. The state of the immune system determines mortality. And that in Africa, because so many people are infected with parasites, their immunity is extremely low and they have poor nutrition, that their mortality is dramatically higher with diseases that would barely affect Americans. So that's well known in the epidemiology literature. And as well in the experimental literature, we do these things in animals. We find that if you remove these nutrients, animals are highly susceptible to these viruses, that in well-nutritious animals, it's not has no mortality at all. This is with the Coxsackie virus. If you have vitamin E and selenium, the Coxsackie virus has no effect. If you're deficient, it's the number one cause for people needing heart transplants. The nutrition makes a lot of difference.
Is that what then is producing the myocarditis?
Right.
I had no idea. Well, I'm sure glad you researched all of these things. Like, you don't have time to keep up with it. That's amazing. Certainly myocarditis is such a terrible, terrible disease. Well, anyway, I want to thank you so much for staying up late tonight and being with us and, of course, edifying our audience out across America. Thanks so much for being with us. We'll look forward to having you on our afternoon program next week.
Thanks, Stan. I appreciate it.
Bye-bye. Good night. And again, of course, our guest has been Dr. Russell Blaylock. His book is, of course, Health and Nutrition Secrets That Can Save Your Life. And if you'd like to know anything more about that, why, you could give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR if you'd like information on Dr. Blaylock's, what I believe is excellent book, because it tells you how to build up your immunity. And in times like that, or like this, I should say, that's something that's really very, very important. Well, of course, this is the time we need to mention to you that Radio Liberty is listener-supported, and we do hope that many of you out there will give serious consideration to joining the Radio Liberty family of supporters, because that's how we're able to do what we do, 5 hours a day, and then on 35 stations on the weekend. But if you just give us a call and ask about joining the Radio Liberty family, or if you'd like to get a free copy of one of our newsletters, I think probably the March newsletter will give you a tremendous insight into why we went to war in Iraq. And we simply quote from the website, in large part of the Project for the New American Century, that of course has members like Donald Rumsfeld, Dick Cheney, Paul Wolfowitz, John Boland, right down the line of the War Cabinet. They all belonged back in 1997, and they were all planning on the war with Iraq. And maybe that's why we didn't find any weapons of mass destruction. Do you think that might be the case? Well, ladies and gentlemen, pray for America. Pray for our leaders. And till tomorrow at the same time, Dr. Stan, good night, and may the Lord be with you.
Time with the gun control stuff, that always gets people going.
Yeah. Well, he is certainly the leading expert we have. He did such a good job.
Oh, it makes such perfect sense as well. So a couple things I think you might be interested in. One,
as I was...
You want me to see your friend?
Dave Emery?
Yeah.
Or
yeah.
I gave him the number. I'm going to give him a call next Monday night. And
okay.
Just, what's up? Because he said...
Hi, Shree.
Hey there. He said he was going to give you a call.
Uh-huh.
So...
Well, that's what he does.
Yes, definitely. Another thing is... I was